everyone. Welcome to episode 4 of Elevate You Pod. I am Mary.
I am Diego.
And we are your performance consultants. Before we get started, I would like to thank Gwen Brown for our artwork. She is one of my favorite people and agreed to draw the artwork for the cover for the podcast. I fell in love with Gwen's work years ago, and I knew that she would be the perfect person to create the artwork. So thank you so much, Gwen, for your dedication and friendship. On our last episode, we talked about our emotions and how identifying them helps us to better understand them so that we can make them work better for us. Based on the feedback that we've been getting, it seems like a few of you out there really appreciated the validation that understanding your feelings is important and talking about it does not make you a weak person. We all have feelings, we all have emotions, and we all react to them. Not everyone reacts to them the same way, but we all react. I hope that you are working on how to manage your emotions, and if you need more guidance, feel free to reach out.
Please do.
Yes, please do. Diego, I have a question for you.
What is it?
Have you ever been anxious about something?
Never. I'm perfect.
Never?
I'm just kidding. Yes. A lot of the times, yes, I've been anxious.
Yes? Do you mind sharing any of those moments?
So ironically enough, I used to be very anxious about speaking in front of people, really? Which we'll get into, I think, in a future episode. Whenever I go play soccer, like right before we start playing, I'll feel like a spike of anxiety. But as soon as I start playing, it like evens out. But those are that one is a bit more of like less of an actual impact on me, I feel like. But there are times where it's like if I'm in a new social situation with people I don't know, it's like, do they like me? Did I say something that makes me look weird or dumb or something?
Yeah, I get that. I get that a lot too. Any others?
And then so sort of similar to your plane one, but mine is an actual part of the flight. So whenever we're like landing and I can hear and feel the landing gear,
yes,
like engage.
Yes.
And then like right as it's about to touch ground, I just feel like a spike of anxiety again until the plane stops bouncing and the brakes actually come loose a little bit.
Yeah.
One time I was on a very, very small plane and made a touchdown when we landed on the ground. Initially we bounced back up like 30 feet in the air. It was terrifying because I was not expecting it whatsoever.
Oh, I would have cried.
I wouldn't have blamed you.
But honestly, for me, when I start to hear the landing gear come down, that's where I get that sense of relief, like okay,
so
close to the ground, we're good. You know, I don't think about bouncing back up. So thank you for putting that into my head.
Oh, you're welcome. Now we both share that one.
Yes, we do. So we all know that I have a fear of flying and that creates anxiety for me among other things. And I think that you and I are certainly not alone in having anxiety in certain situations. But did you know that 40 million adults are affected in some way by anxiety?
You know, I had an idea that it was a very large number, but not that exact number.
40 million.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And I know this is recent because I did recent research to pull that number up. I can't remember the exact date, but it's in the last few years.
Okay.
40 million. That's a lot. But
definitely.
Yeah. So really quick before we move on that, do you remember in your sports psych courses, an author, Shane Murphy, he talked about anxiety. And I was really intrigued by his definition. He talked about anxiety being an anticipatory emotion, a future-oriented response to a perceived but vague threat that makes us feel powerless because we cannot protect ourselves from an uncertain, an unpredictable event. So the action or response usually is associated with escape or avoidance. So what do you think, or what are some common things or common ways that we feel anxiety?
Yeah. So personally for me, it's like, I definitely notice that my heart rate starts to spike. Mm-hmm. My hands get quite clammy, depending on how severe the anxiety is, start like sweating a little bit, but also like the butterflies in the stomach type of feeling, and like not in the good way.
Right.
But ultimately those are just the ways that anxiety affects me personally. For someone else who also experiences anxiety to, let's say, for example, the same severity that I do in any given moment, they might experience different physiological reactions. So it may be as gross and as severe as throwing up.
Yeah.
Or it could be just shutting down completely and not really showing any type of emotional reaction in the moment. It just depends on the individual, really, and their past experiences, too. Because we are essentially operating out of fight or flight. And if it's flight can look different depending on the person. So flight might be physically leaving the situation, or emotionally leaving the situation, mm-hmm. i.e. shutting down and not really interacting with anything, including people or the situation itself.
Yeah, I have a very close friend who is, that's how she operates, is completely shuts down. She cannot function in that moment. And, you know, we use different techniques to help her come out of that, but she can't think, she can't feel anything. She cannot bring herself in that moment to do or think or feel anything. So yeah, it does look different to a lot of people. Can you guess the current population who experiences the most anxiety?
Is it millennials?
It is millennials. And I kind of had a hunch it was after looking up some stats on it. Mm-hmm. I have my thoughts on why, but since you are in the millennial group, why don't you share some thoughts on why?
Yeah, I completely represent everything that it means to be a millennial. But I found an article that spoke specifically about millennials experiencing anxiety more so than other generations. So they're just stressed out in general. So from what I understand, 14% of millennials do suffer from anxiety. And at the same time, millennials are more likely to seek out psychotherapy, aka therapy, it's just another way to say it, more often than other members of Gen X or other earlier generations. There is some guidance as to why that might be a factor. And one of the biggest things that I saw was decision making playing a role into why millennials are anxious and why they feel the need for psychotherapy to begin with.
It's decision making?
Yeah, decision making. One of the ideas is that because millennials are for the first time facing big choices that are likely to have lifelong consequences. And, you know, I think this article was written a couple of years ago. So there are millennials who have already gone through a lot of big life altering decisions to make. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty about how they should make these decisions. And that's one big thing. But there are other facets of decision related anxiety as well. So some young adults may find that they have too many choices and that trying to distinguish between their options is a bit overwhelming, if not very overwhelming. A lot of millennials are, you know, they fall under the analysis paralysis, or you might know it as paralysis by analysis. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of hard to say. One right after the other. But essentially, it's having difficulty seeing why one option is better than another, and then feeling unable to make a choice or decision at all. With that said, though, I did find some more articles talking about a new term that's going around, and it's essentially called high-functioning anxiety. This type of anxiety tends to be more associated with work and social situations. Okay. And this can look like someone who arrives at work way earlier than everyone else, always looking their best, nothing's ever out of place, never miss a due date, and rarely, if ever, not giving their full effort and attention to whatever is in front of them at work. And they're always willing to help other people at the drop of a hat. And they always seem to be pretty busy with their social lives. But ultimately, it seems like these individuals have, you know, everything together. But that's on the surface. on the inside, their internal world seems to be very full of anxiousness. There are a variety of reasons why this can occur, and one of them being a fear of failure. And I think that can look a variety of ways, and that can be instilled within someone a variety of ways, because it's such a vague, you know, phrase, right?
Right.
But there's also being afraid of disappointing others. So people tend to equate those two reasons as being key factors in terms of why people with high functioning anxiety also tend to be successful. However, there are often a lot of unproductive behaviors and qualities that go along with that type of success. So for example, these people tend to struggle with the feeling of needing to be a people pleaser. So they never say no whenever someone needs their help or whenever there's, you know, another project and that needs to be addressed. And, you know, they might have a lot on their plate already, but they're not going to say no.
That can be very overwhelming.
Definitely. Especially if I would imagine some people might not know either how to say no or the fact that their plate is already full.
Right.
There are also nervous habits like biting nails, playing with hair. Exactly, Mary.
I'm demonstrating.
Yeah. There's also overthinking. I think it'd be safe to throw in rumination there as well. Those two seem to go hand in hand. Also needing a high level of reassurance or validation, ruminating on past mistakes and potential what ifs. And a lot of people tend to view this type of anxiety as a double-edged sword because they are experiencing success, but at the expense of their internal world, at the expense of an idea that what they experience is their normal way of existing, when that's just a way of existing, not necessarily the way, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. I do want to clarify that for the purpose of our podcast, we would like to focus on anxiety in more general terms as it pertains to performance. We are not qualified to do more than give you our opinions about other types. We all experience anxiety to some extent, and some have stronger reactions than others do. However, we are trained and educated in performance anxiety, and Diego is going to talk to you a little bit about what a performance is.
So I think one way to think about performance is if you think about sports. So in sport, performance really involves the development of very specific pieces of knowledge, skills, and abilities over time, and then being able to apply those different bits of knowledge, those different skills and abilities during a specific performance event that carries some type of outcome that is valued, but also the application of that knowledge, skills, and abilities are measured against some type of standard of success. So you can think of that standard of success as either winning or losing. There is an expectation about how these bits of knowledge, these skills, these abilities are put into action, and therefore the execution of those knowledge, skills, and abilities is evaluated by the performer. So that might be you and others. So if you're in a team environment, it'd be your teammates or your groupmates, and depending on the context, could be a superior who is evaluating you, or it could be just some external panel of judges in the case of something like diving. But we are finding life also has many performances.
Many performances.
Yes. And they can include athletic competition, like I just mentioned, the performance of a play by an actor, a military unit following a rehearsed plan, firefighters executing a rehearsed protocol, or salespeople delivering a detailed pitch they practiced beforehand. As Mary alluded to earlier, we, meaning Mary and I, view anxiety as it relates to different performances we experience throughout our lives, whether it's sports, jobs, or relationships. So that should give you all some context as to where we're coming from. So for some of us, anxiety has been there in those performances which may have impacted the quality of our performance either negatively or forced us to make sure we did a good job. Ultimately, it is up to you to determine what your performances are and if you're letting anxiety get the best of you. And we're hoping this episode can give you some information and tools that can help push you towards that anxiety that helps rather than harms.
And again, remember that anxiety is an emotion. And last time, you know, we talked about having them serve us and understanding them in a way that they serve us. We want to have some anxiety and we want to use it to elevate our performance and to do our best. So yes.
You don't want to let it get the best of you, but harness it in a way that can propel you in the direction you want to go.
He's so eloquent, isn't he? I love how he speaks. That's so great.
Me and words sometimes go good.
Yes. Sometimes you're gooder. Yes. So I've spoken to several young women between the ages of 20 to 25, and they seem to all have similar stories regarding their anxiety. They've listed that at times it can be just completely debilitating. They've listed times where it can be minor, but enough to cause some sort of reaction. They've also mentioned how it can lead to irrational decision-making, and at times it can just be a moment and then it's gone. So today we actually have the pleasure of speaking to a young woman who is close to my heart, who has volunteered to tell her story and how anxiety is very real for her. I've seen part of her journey firsthand, and while I cannot fully understand it, I do sympathize with it and hope that through this interview, her journey can help others along their path as well. So I would like to say welcome to Lauren. Thank you so much for being here with us and sharing your story. I am certain your experiences will resonate with others.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, and I hope so as well.
So a lot of people don't know you, and I would like our listeners to get to know you a little bit. So if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about you, and you're actually quite successful in what you do in life. So tell us a little bit about that story as well.
All right. Hi, everybody. So a little bit about me. Okay. I was born in Vancouver, Canada, moved to Arizona when I was 10 months old. So don't remember much about Vancouver other than the fact that I have dual citizenship. I'm an only child raised in Phoenix, Arizona, and I was a competitive gymnast growing up. Unfortunately, due to some circumstances, including that I was a terrible gymnast, I ended up quitting gymnastics when I was about 13, but I've had a passion for the sport ever since. So since then, I have started my own company where I build one-page websites for gymnasts who are trying to get recruited for college. And since starting that in March of 2017, the brand itself has kind of taken off. So I've started to do a lot of apparel and other gymnastics related items on the e-commerce platform. So that's been taking up a lot of time recently. And I also work as a sales advisor for a gymnastics apparel company. I'm currently just wrapped up my third year at Arizona State. I'm double majoring in marketing and business entrepreneurship. I just got a super cute little puppy. So I felt like I should add that as well.
Absolutely, you should. So that's a lot to do since you were, at what age did you start?
I quit gymnastics around 12, 13, and I started interning for a gymnastics website. I was doing some video content for them when I was in seventh grade, so 13. So I must have quit gymnastics when I was 12.
My goodness, she's accomplished, isn't she?
I'd say so.
Yeah, I would say so too. So tell us a little bit about what qualities you think you possess that makes you so successful.
I would say there's quite a few qualities that go into being a successful person. And there are hundreds, thousands of people who are much more successful than I am. However, I would say the biggest quality or the most important quality that goes into my success is my drive and just the relentless attitude I have when I really want to accomplish something. Once I have a goal in mind, I'm going to do really whatever I can do to accomplish that goal. I started having that kind of relentless drive at a really young age. You know, my dad would tell me I can't get something at the store or can't go to Build-A-Bear, and I would do absolutely anything I could to change his mind. So while it's been successful for me, I would say not everybody loves that character in me. So yeah, definitely that relentless drive. And of course that contributes to having a lot of self-motivation. No one's ever had to tell me, you know, Lauren, get going on this. Lauren, you need to do this. Even as a kid, Lauren, have you done your homework? So I think that really has to do with it as well.
So you may not have known it at the time. However, I think you've expressed you can identify a moment in time where you think your anxiety began.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of one of those moments that I actually very vividly remember. I was 9 years old and I had just come home from gymnastics practice. And my mom had made me one of my favorite dinners as a kid, mac and cheese. Yum. And for whatever reason, I just could not eat the food. I was very hungry. I wanted to eat the food, but for whatever reason, I couldn't swallow the food. There wasn't even really a fear yet. It was just couldn't swallow. So I just basically told my parents I wasn't hungry. Not super unusual. There were some days where I just worked really hard in the gym and I just wasn't hungry. So I went to bed with not much thought to it. Just maybe I was extremely tired and literally could not eat or something else. Well, that ended up not being the case. So over the next year or so, I ended up dealing with a fear of swallowing, which was really a fear of choking, a fear of not being able to breathe, all of that. And after the competition season was over, my parents and I made the decision that I should maybe take a break from gymnastics, just because at 9 years old, that was the biggest stressor I had in my life. So, you know, let's remove the big stressor and see if everything, you know, kind of goes back to normal. While that did take a lot of stress out of my life, the fear of choking continued. I saw multiple doctors, multiple therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, even had a small surgery in the hospital to make sure that there wasn't actually anything lodged in my throat. There was not. And now I recognize that as the moment I really started having anxiety, but I didn't realize it at the time. After a year, I was able to recover from that. However, I've had my anxiety since then. So that's gone into other aspects of my life.
Besides the not being able to swallow your food, were there any other signs or experiences that you noticed that now looking back tell you like, yeah, that was anxiety for sure?
I would say yes. Even though I was a gymnast, I had a major fear of tumbling backwards. And that caused me a lot of stress in and outside the gym. Anytime I had to do it on my own, tumble on my own, or coach was getting frustrated and yelling at me, I mean, I would cry a ton. You know, when I wouldn't do what I was supposed to, I was sent to the back to condition. And I would say that was definitely a start of anxiety because it definitely stressed me out. However, a human being afraid of throwing their body backwards, I'm pretty sure that's pretty normal. So that's not super unusual, but definitely the stress that came out of that, I would say, contributed to the anxiety for sure.
So looking back, were there specific strategies or tactics that you were using then to try to mitigate the anxiety or cope with it?
So the first solution before seeing any sort of doctors was that my parents decided to put my food in a blender. And I said, absolutely not. That's disgusting. I'm not drinking pizza.
Me either.
So after, you know, a week or so of experiencing this anxiety, we started reaching out to friends and were my parents' friends and getting a recommendation for a therapist, someone who could help me with my anxiety. And that was definitely a process because there are thousands and thousands of psychologists and therapists and psychiatrists, but not as many child psychologists. And then you go into, okay, even child sports psychologists, it gets smaller and smaller. And so went through a lot of those professionals that it wasn't getting better. I dreaded going to them. There was one that made me pop balloons, and all of a sudden that was supposed to make my fear go away. If anything, it made me even more terrified. So after seeing a bunch of different psychologists, I found one that really worked well for me. And then I also saw a psychiatrist on the side. And after quite a few meetings with him and my family, we decided that going the medication route might be a good idea in order to help. And that was definitely a hard decision, because my parents, even though I was only at this point 10 years old, they allowed me to be a part of the decision. And one of my fears, as well as my parents, was, okay, I don't want to be on a medication for the rest of my life. But it was one of those things where I'd been dealing this for a year. I had dropped significant weight. I mean, I looked like a skeleton. That if we combine the medication along with continuing to seek therapy, that might be the best route. So that's what I did. And after starting that medication and going to therapy, that's when the symptoms definitely those immediate anxiety symptoms began to resolve.
You had mentioned earlier in one of your responses that your anxiety impacts other areas. Can you talk a little bit about how it affects relationships in your life?
Yeah, for sure. So like I mentioned, my fear of swallowing and choking was resolved after about a year or so. However, the anxiety itself didn't go away. One aspect in particular, and this is something that has basically gone on really since then, is I have a major fear of vomiting. And unfortunately, for someone who gets sick a lot, that's probably one of the worst fears to have. However, anytime I start to feel nauseous, am nauseous, I go into full-on panic attack. Basically, to the point, not to get too graphic here, to where I'm basically bursting at the seams because I'm freaking out so much. I know I'm sick to my stomach, but I don't want to go and vomit. And this has definitely impacted relationships and stuff, because I remember always hearing about my friends in high school going out and drinking and, oh, getting so sick that they were nonstop throwing up all night. And I was thinking, well, that's my biggest fear. So I don't want to go out and party and drink and to the point where I start throwing up. So I really missed out on a lot of high school parties, and a lot of my friends would go out to parties and I would make up some excuse as to why I couldn't go. But that really all kind of boiled down to anxiety. And with that, I also have a lot of anxiety in large social settings. I know a lot of people don't enjoy being in a huge room with a bunch of people and having to walk the room and introduce themselves. However, with me, I will not talk to anybody unless they come up and talk to me first. So of course, on the outside, that looks like I'm cold. I don't have any interest in being where I am. I don't want to talk to anybody at all. When on the inside, I really just want someone to come and say hi to me, because I personally think that once you get to know me, I'm pretty fun.
I would agree with
that. Okay, that's good. I would have been super awkward if she said
no. Yeah, of all people, yeah.
But yeah, so I would say definitely the social anxiety and definitely that kind of fear of vomiting has been the most impactful in my relationships throughout life.
Can I ask what it is about vomiting that you fear?
It's probably, and again, it's one of those that I just still haven't been able to figure out, because I do get sick a lot and I have had to vomit multiple times. And every time, I mean, I'm still here. For the most part, it's probably not being able to breathe. And again, I hate to get graphic here because it's absolutely disgusting, but you know, when it keeps coming up and coming up, like you don't have a chance to breathe. But again, I'm still here. I've been sick multiple times. I've had multiple stomach flus, but it still just totally freaks me out. And it's one of those things where I can sit here and you can tell me and I can tell you, yeah, I know I'm going to be completely fine. I know it's completely natural. But when I'm in that moment, I start feeling nauseous, that anxiety just completely takes over.
So looking back then compared to now, would you say, is there anything that's significantly different in terms of how anxiety has impacted you in your daily life?
Yes, for sure. So Nowadays, because I'm extremely busy and have basically filled my schedule up to the brim, I definitely experience anxiety at night once I'm winding down for the day. I try and shut my laptop off around 9:30, 10-ish, and I know that's not healthy at all. I realize I should probably be shutting it down around 5 or 6. And once I've really shut down for the night is when I start feeling anxious. I get a lot of, and I realize we're not going into OCD or any of that, but a lot of kind of OCD thoughts, you know, go make sure you've locked the door or else XYZ is going to happen. Even though I know the door is locked because I've already done it 5 times, but there's still that, well, you know, what happens if you don't? What if something does happen? And again, it goes back to what I was explaining with the fear of vomiting is I know that me making sure that my toothbrush is in the cup has absolutely no correlation whatsoever with whether or not my dad's flight is going to land well tomorrow or not. And you say that to that logic part of your brain, but the other part of your brain's like, well, how do you know that? You know, it just, it's playing all these mind games with you. So that's where I definitely experience the most anxiety in my day-to-day life. But like I said, I'm extremely busy throughout the day. So as long as there isn't some sort of random trigger that causes me to have a full-on panic attack or I become nauseous or any of that, throughout the day, I really do not experience any anxiety.
So when you are experiencing, let's say after you shut down your laptop for the day, what do you do in the moment to kind of get you outside of that anxiety or at least lessen it?
Well, I do a lot of self-talk.
Nice.
Yes. And I know you guys talked about that. Sometimes, I'm not going to lie, it's kind of negative self-talk. It's, you know, get it together, stop being stupid, go on Twitter and go to bed. Other times it is, you know, more nurturing, more, hey, you know, yeah, you've had a stressful day. This is probably why you're thinking this way. You know, it's not correlated. You know, you'll be fine. Just go to bed. And then other times I don't cope with it and end up staying up for an extra hour, just checking the lock 1800 times. But it really does depend. It really just depends on kind of my mood. There's no really way of assessing why sometimes I'm more positive or negative or don't even try to fix it at all. It's just kind of is what it is.
I mean, I think there's something there to be said that like there are some times where we're going to be on our A game and being able to regulate whatever it is that we're trying to control or manage. And there's going to be some days where it's just not happening for one reason or another. And, you know, I'm assuming, this is me assuming that you've had some time with to use these strategies repeatedly. Is that okay to assume?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right. So another point I think there to be made is like regardless of how long or how many times you've actually used these types of skills, there's still going to be days where it's going to be very hard to see the benefits or see what you're trying to get out of these skills. But that doesn't mean you're undoing all those other times of progress that you've seen in the past.
Yeah,
and as time goes on, hoping that the more practice with these skills, you'll be able to see less of the days where it's hard to actually manage what you're trying to manage, whether it's anxiety or any other intense emotion. And you'll see more of the days that you're able to successfully manage whatever it is that you're trying to manage. Anyway, long-winded. So going back to strategies, what type of support do you have that you could reliably rely on?
Well, I have a couple different streams of support. So one, I started seeing a great psychologist in the summer of 2019, and he's taught me a lot of different coping mechanisms for when I am feeling anxious or stressed or just even have a moment to basically breathe. And then I have a set of two very, very good friends that I met in the past year that are basically my daily therapists. So
those are great people to have.
And then of course my parents. And Mary's pretty cool too, I guess.
Well, thank you.
So something happened to you between your freshman and sophomore year of college. Can you share with us that story?
Yeah, of course. So I, as I mentioned, I grew up in Phoenix, and I knew pretty much, as long as I knew college was a thing and that many people went to college, that I wanted to go to school out of state, whether it was across the country, one state over, north, south, east, west, wherever. I ended up going to school in Los Angeles, and first semester I did great. I made some good friends. I got straight A's, had a great first semester. I went home for a Christmas break along with everybody else, and it was about a 4 or 5 week Christmas break, and going back was definitely hard. I loved the time I spent with my family. I wasn't necessarily sad to go back, but I was sad to be leaving behind my family. That was definitely a hard part. I was also, my roommate and I weren't really getting along during that first fall semester. So a couple of friends and I actually decided to end up getting an apartment for the spring semester. So there were some things to look forward to. I was excited to move into that apartment, to have my own bathroom where I could shower without shower shoes. Super excited about that. So I ended up feeling pretty okay about going back for the spring semester. A couple of weeks in, we had our spring recruitment for joining a sorority. And as someone that does struggle with social anxiety, it was definitely a hard weekend for me, for sure. Everybody tells you to go into rushing and everything with an open mind and that everything will work out. But of course, there's also people telling you in your other ear, well, you don't want to get with this sorority. If this sorority chooses you, it's the loser sorority, and don't do this and don't do that. And for someone that was already really struggling to go out and rush, that alone in itself was also another huge struggle. So fast forward, ended up not getting the sororities that I wanted to get into. I ended up getting into a good sorority. I really liked the girls. They were very genuine. While I was anxious, I was also somewhat go with the flow with the whole thing. Liking the sorority at first, thought that I was going to be okay. And then along with that social anxiety of being in a sorority and all of that, I just sort of started to shut down. And I just want to go back and say that it definitely wasn't the sorority that made me sort of shut down. It was probably the sorority being away from home, being in school, away from home, just all of those stressors going into one. But anyways, I just kind of sort of started to shut down. The first thing I wanted to do when I woke up was go back to bed. I would look at the clock all day. Okay, you know what? It's almost 7 p.m. I can go to bed. And I'm a night owl, so going to bed at 7 p.m. isn't normal at all. But I just wanted to basically be done with the day. A homework assignment that would normally take me 1 hour would take me 4 hours. And I was just done. I think I keep saying that, but that was the best way to describe it. I remember my mom flew out. Once I kind of let her and my dad know that I was really struggling, my mom flew out. And I just remember going for walks on the beach with her and me just bawling my eyes out. Just, I didn't know why I was feeling this way. A lot of me felt weak for that. I couldn't handle being in college out of state. I was mad at myself. I didn't understand why I was feeling the way I was feeling, especially when first semester went so well. I couldn't figure out, well, why could I handle the first few months of being away from home, but now I can't? Just a lot of confusion, a lot of emotions. I ended up deciding to transfer to Arizona State after my first semester in LA, or first year in LA. I started seeing a psychologist twice a week, which is the one I mentioned as a part of my support system. And as time went on and he taught me a lot more coping mechanisms, that twice a week went to once a week, went to bi-weekly. And now I'm at the point where I have these coping mechanisms and I can just see him really as needed as a check-in process.
So given all of that, tell us, what are the reasons why you keep pushing through your anxiety?
I would say I keep pushing through the anxiety because I really have a drive to be successful and happy in this, hopefully, long life I have ahead of me. And I firsthand know that just avoiding anxiety isn't the best idea. And I know it sounds cheesy to say the only way what do they say? The only way to get, the only way out is through. Yeah. That's what it is. And so dealing with something like anxiety isn't exactly fun. Yeah, it's not enjoyable, but you just have to kind of deal with it. And I'm never one that wants my anxiety to be anything that prohibits me from accomplishing what I want to accomplish. And like I said, I've tried to avoid anxiety, my anxiety, at least throughout the years. And you just kind of have to hit it head on.
And I got to tell you, after knowing you for the last 5 years, I don't see you doing it any other way. You are driven. You are. I wish you guys could see her face right now. You're very driven and you're dedicated. And, you know, you do have that relentless quality that a lot of us wish that we had. So congrats to you. I'm really excited to see where you go from here. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I know that some of these stories are not always easy to talk about, your experiences. We really do appreciate your vulnerability. And we hope that your story made an impact on someone and can help them move forward as well. Thank you again for being here with us.
And thank you for having me. And if there's one person I can help, then this was definitely worth it.
Agreed.
For sure. So now that we've all heard some of the techniques, strategies that Lauren learned from her different resources, we're also going to offer you all a couple of different strategies that can help you lessen the anxiety in the moment. So the first one is called diaphragmatic breathing. So this is coming straight from Harvard. So you know the research is like pretty good. But essentially what is happening here is when we breathe from our diaphragm, which is a muscle that is underneath the lungs, by the way, I learned that. Mm-hmm. We are encouraging full oxygen exchange. And one of the benefits of trading in incoming oxygen for outgoing carbon dioxide, this type of breathing slows our heartbeat and can lower and even stabilize blood pressure. So essentially what that does is allow us to get out of fight or flight and reactivate the parts of our brain that are essential for critical thinking, for taking in more information and processing that information so we can make better decisions in the moment. So first, I'm going to go through some of the instructions to encourage proper diaphragmatic breathing. So what you want to do first is set the stage, right? So you either want to lie on your back on a flat surface, like in a bed or on the ground, as long as you're comfortable, that's what's more important. Or sitting upright in a chair with your feet flat on the ground and your arms in a neutral position, not crossed, probably on your sides or on your lap, something like that. And what you want to do initially is place one hand on your upper chest and the other on your belly, just below your rib cage. What I find that helps me get into the rhythm of diaphragmatic breathing is using some type of visualization aid. So for me, what really helped me was thinking of, hopefully you've all seen a baby breathe. So if they're lying on their back, you can really see the sides of their belly and their belly itself expand pretty fully. And, you know, if you can really harness that image and have it rhythmically time with how you're breathing, that can be one great way to help you get into that flow as well. For whatever reason, as we're born, we naturally breathe diaphragmatically, but as we grow older and mature, we tend to forget how to do that, or at least not do it as regularly. The benefits definitely are there for the taking. It's just a matter of practicing. So anyway, back to the instructions. So with the one hand on your upper chest and the other on your belly, breathe in slowly through your nose, letting the air in deeply towards your lower belly. At the same time, the hand on your chest should remain as still as possible, while the hand on your belly should be rising. And what you also want to experience is tightening your abdominal muscles, letting them fall inward as you exhale through your mouth. If it helps to purse your lips up, kind of like a fish, go ahead and do that. Otherwise, as long as you're experiencing your abdominal muscles moving much more than your chest, that's the key here. And as you exhale, the hand on your belly should move down to its original position. If you want to get, you know, level two at this thing, throwing in some type of rhythm also helps. So if it's like a count of inhaling for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then holding for a second or two, then exhaling for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it doesn't have to be 5. It can be a count of 4 or 6, whatever helps you. But the idea is to get your mind in the present moment and really away from any of the anticipated threats you might have detected, which is essentially what anxiety, or where it stems from. Breathing in this manner allows your body to start the relaxation response. And this allows us to turn our brains back on, like I mentioned before, whenever we start to feel too anxious about a performance coming up or about any given situation. And personally, this is my favorite way to combat a lot of the anxiety I feel, because it's scalable, meaning that you can take 10 minutes doing this and see some effects, or it really can take like all of 10 seconds and you'll start seeing some benefits. But the 10 second portion needs to have more practice behind it for you to start seeing those benefits that you want to see. And, you know, like every other skill we talk about, the more you practice, the better you'll get at it, the easier it becomes, and the more benefits you see. So now that we've learned how to breathe diaphragmatically, let's move on to the second strategy, which is called grounding. And some of you all may have some experience with this one. And if you have, great. If not, I'm going to go through this one as well. So this grounding technique is called the 5-4-3-2-1 technique. What you are doing here is intentionally noticing details of your surroundings using each of your senses. So the aim here is to pick up on small details that your mind would usually tune out, such as distant sounds or the texture of an ordinary object, maybe like the desk that's in front of you or the chair you're sitting on. So essentially what you want to do first is look around the room that you are in, or in the immediate space you're in, and identify what are 5 things you can see. And whether it's verbally stating them out loud or just saying to yourself, as long as you're identifying and expressing them in some way, that's the key here. So, Mary, what are 5 things you can see?
5 things I can see.
Yes.
I can see my laptop screen. I can see a vase that my son made. I can see my water bottle. I can see my pen. I can see my cell phone.
Nice. Also, I want to make a note here. You're not always going to have someone asking you these questions.
No.
And oftentimes, if you do want to use a technique or find a situation where you want to use this technique, you're going to have to rely on yourself to ask these questions. Right. So moving on, what are 4 things you can feel? So this is involving your sense of touch.
I can feel the hardness of the desk. I can feel my chair underneath me. I can feel the coldness of my water bottle, and I can feel the air from the air conditioning vent.
Nice. All right. Next one. What are 3 things you can hear?
3 things I can hear. I can hear Diego's voice. I can hear the humming of the air conditioner, and I can hear my bulldog scratching at the door.
Poor Nugget.
Yes.
What are 2 things you can smell?
2 things I can smell. I can smell bacon in the oven, and I can smell the candle burning on the desk.
All right. Last one. What is 1 thing you can taste?
1 thing I can taste is the water on my lips.
All right. So another important note here is you don't have to pick up on like extraordinary things happening around you. It's more so to get your mind back to the present, very similarly to the diaphragmatic breathing and incorporating that rhythmic counting as well. This one involves all your senses, so you're deliberately distracting your brain in this case to, well, not only distracting, but you're giving your brain an active target at the same time to identify whatever it is you need to identify. So whether it's the 5 things you see, feel, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, this is my favorite technique. I really like this one a lot. I've used it on a few people. I've used it on myself. I don't always go the 5-4-3-2-1. Mm-hmm. If I need something quick and immediate, I'll stick with 2, 2, and 2, and 2 just to kind of jolt me back to where I need to be. But if I have enough time, then I can do the 5-4-3-2-1.
Yeah, I think that's also a great point. You can scale this as needed, right? So if you do have the time, like Mary said, yeah, do the 5-4-3-2-1, especially if you find that effective for you. But if all you really need is to use 3 of your senses, then maybe it is 2, 2, and 2 or 3, 3, and 3, depending on, you know, you and what works for you.
Exactly. And again, with all of these skills, it takes practice. And practicing these skills will only make them stronger for when you really need to use them. So take some time and practice these skills.
Practice.
Thanks, Diego, for going over those for us. I really do appreciate that. I know that a lot of people are going to try this, and I can't wait to hear how they, you know, go about doing it. And I can't wait to hear about their experiences.
For sure. Please share feedback if you use any of these strategies.
We would love to hear about it. Thank you guys so much for being here with us again today. Hopefully you heard something that you can use to elevate you. If you want to know more about how to acknowledge, understand, and regulate your emotions, we are always happy to help. If you are not already, please follow us on Instagram at azsportspsych. And to follow the podcast, you can find us on Instagram as well at ElevateYouPod. Our goal last month was to hit 100 followers. We did not meet that goal for the month of April. So we're going to move it on into the month of May to hopefully reach that goal. So if you are not already following us, please head on over to Instagram and do that. We recently did create a Facebook page as well. So look for us on Facebook too. If you have any questions, feedback, comments, telling us how to use your how you used your strategies, we would love to hear about it. And you can email us, elevateyou@azsportspsych.com is our email address. And again, we are working diligently to respond to all those emails as quickly as we can. So just be patient with us. On our next episode, we have another great interview discussing anxiety and being a high performer in the professional world. So be sure to watch for the launch of that episode. Please share our info with friends and family. Even if our content is not for you, someone you know may benefit from it. Again, thank you guys so much for listening. Until next time.
See ya.